Judiciary coming order. Today's April 16th. We're going to go out of order on the schedule. The first item we're going to hear today is open a public hearing on House Bill 3480. We have a lot of witnesses today. And so I'm going to ask people to please try to keep it no more than 3 minutes in there when they speak. I want to give everybody a chance to have their full say. But if you don't already know, on Thursday is the deadline. We have to get all these bills through or they will fall off the table. We're going to have a night. We plan on a night meeting to try and get them through, but it'd be helpful if we can get them through during the daytime. I'd like to call Representative Gallegos, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. And committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. For the record, my name is Joe Gallegos. I'm the representative for House District 30, which is Hillsborough, North Plains, parts of Washington County. The bill we're looking at, House Bill 3480, changes the definition crimes of intimidation to bias crimes. This is a subtle but significant change in terminology. We'll hear testimony from folks that will give you more specific data and personal accounts of the incidence and prevalence of these types of crimes, often referred to as hate crimes. The data will show that there is a continuation of bias crime. Attached is an article that I wrote a few years ago when I was director of the Northwest Center for the Study of Violence and Development, project funded by U.S. Agency on International Development. The project studied the violence aimed at ethnic minorities. We learned that the extent of violent crimes committed are based solely on victims' ethnicity. I was surprised to learn through my research that Oregon and the Northwest is considered and continues to be a center for hate groups. We also learned that the term hate crime was too limiting for a full investigation of the phenomenon. It was evident to us that the issue was confined to legalistic terms of crime, so we decided that a better descriptor was the term bias-motivated violence. This allowed us to consider a broader range of motive than just the ill-defined term hate. We considered a continuum of motivation from discomfort to dislike to the downright hatred of persons broadly categorized as belonging to an over-categorized group of people. Thus, we can consider a range of intimidation aimed at an array of groups as an act of violence aimed at a group and not an individual. Bias-motivated violence or bias crimes take on a more severe consequences. For example, if a person is mugged outside the building and their wallet stolen, we can simply write that off as being in the wrong place at the wrong time. That person can rightly feel victimized. However, if someone is mugged outside the building because of their ethnicity or their sexual orientation, this person is a victim for a reason they cannot change. The innocent victim or the innocent person is a victim because of who they are. And when it's a case, in that case, it's no longer just the victim who is victimized, but really the whole community to which they're associated. So bias crime, it reaches far into the minds of the victim, and symptoms are basically post-traumatic stress, very similar to rape cases or other kinds of traumatic incidents. As you can see, and as you will hear from those who will follow me, this is a serious matter. It is one that requires our careful attention, and clarifying our terminology will help to make our response and interventions to this problem more effective. This is the right step to make, and we urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Eagles? Thank you. You made it 2 minutes and 43 seconds. Good job.
Thank you very much.
Next we'll call Linda Hamilton, Dow Tucker, and Lorraine Wilson, please.
Linda Hamilton.
Hi.
Eugene, Oregon resident.
Okay.
Oh. No, that's not.
Okay. Ms. Hamilton, you can go right ahead. And remember, when you start speaking, to please identify yourself for the record. But you've done that already, so please go.
Linda Hamilton, residents of Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a member of the Human Rights Commission and vice president of Blacks in Government, promoting equity, excellence, and opportunity. I want to thank you for bringing this here today and giving us the opportunity to speak on this. I still want to call it a hate crime, but I accept bias if that's what we want to look at today. But I ask that you seriously consider passing this bill. As you look around Oregon, I'm sure I don't recognize none of you up there, nor do I recognize my rep or anyone from Eugene, Oregon, but if you study and familiar with the area of Oregon and all the different incidents around the state of Oregon that has happened, this type of behavior continues to go around the state of Oregon. And we've had several incidents recently in Eugene, Oregon, as well as one here in Salem around the corner from the state capitol. So I'm going to believe and think and want to hope that you, each and every one of you, are very familiar with the types of crime that has been going on, that you please consider passing this House Bill 3480.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Judiciary Committee members. My name is Dow Tucker, and I'm a resident of Salem and a human resource manager for Salem Health. 2 years ago, I came to Salem, and I found out that Salem in Hebrew means peace. And little did I know that in my search for a place of peace, that it would be something that would not be easily attained. My family and I have dealt with 32 incidents of discrimination since being here. Some actions have been very subtle, and some have been very blatant. I tried to turn a blind eye with the intent to have peace and not create a stir in the community. I turned a blind eye when my husband's truck was illegally towed from a retail parking lot, with the tow truck driver showing hate in his eyes, telling me and my husband, "Keep talking, nigger, and the price goes up." A retail manager came out and told the tow truck driver that we had permission to park there, and he continued to just egg us on and just keep saying, "Keep talking, nigger, the price goes up." A $2,000 tow bill later, and no avail, we did exactly what he said we were going to do. We were going to pay more. I turned a blind eye when my family decided to go out to a family bowling and dinner event where we had a bowling attendant who stood next to our lane and told us that we could not pick up every single ball that we picked up, which we thought came with the price of admission to bowl. We had a quiet drive home that day, and my kids were very upset. I turned a blind eye when we dealt with 4 incidents of racism at our local gym. In one incident, I had a 15-year-old girl look at my husband and call him an effing nigger. And when the manager of our gym made her apologize and approached the parents did not even acknowledge that she had said that to us, nor did they apologize on her behalf. I still turned a blind eye. The day that I couldn't turn a blind eye to this was the day that I walked into my private office at Salem Health and found a bullet staring up at me. And the words, "Leave nigger or die," written on my wall. I am a mom. I work very hard. And someone decided that I didn't have the right to have peace when I moved here so that I could have peace. I ask all of you, when does the color of my skin or my gender or my ethnicity determine the level of treatment I should receive? When does color have character? Some people ask, if I did my research before moving here, did I not know that blacks represent 1% of the population? But you have to understand that I grew up in a very multiracial environment. My mother, who is full-blooded Vietnamese, my stepfather, who raised me for the last 28 years, is a white man, a sergeant major in the United States Marine Corps. So it wouldn't have mattered if I was the only face of color here in Salem. I would have been comfortable, but now I'm not comfortable. Every room that I walk in, I notice that I stick out, and I notice that now I'm different. I humbly ask that you all help and just take a stand. Don't turn a blind eye like I did in the 31 incidents leading up to the incident at Salem Health. Show this community that you have zero tolerance for discrimination and hold anyone accountable that commits a biased crime against another human being. Protect this community against such ignorance and help families and help my family feel safe. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Lorraine Wilson, Hermiston, Oregon, Commissioner on the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. I come to you today to do a presentation on what the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. I have been a commissioner for the last 3 years. And in the last 3 years, and even before that, we've been dealing with a number of incidences that have occurred in Oregon. The Federal Bureau says crimes directed against individuals on the basis of sexual orientation are the second most frequent hate crime committed after crimes based on race, surpassing crimes committed on the basis of religion. The number of reported hate crimes committed against gay men and lesbians increased from 1,277 in 2010 to 1,293 in 2011. July 11, 2007, Redmond, Oregon, LaMarcus Petit. LaMarcus Petit was found dead on the train tracks in Redmond, Oregon. Shortly before he was, the police said that he had been beaten with a handheld weapon at the Tumble Inn Tavern, which is blocks from the tracks. Austin Shacon of Redmond has been arrested for the attack. He was convicted on intimidation and assault in the second degree. It carries a mandatory sentencing of 70 months. Based on my research, I haven't been able to determine if Mr. Shacon was actually, if the investigation determined if the death of LaMichael Petit was a result of what Mr. Shacon did. So to this day, we don't know if he received justice. Someone was held, but we don't know if he received justice. September 2011, Creswell, Oregon. A junior in high school, a student. He is now living in Arizona with his grandmother. She decided to move him out of Oregon. He is considered, they asked, why do you help others? He said, there isn't much of a reason not to, in my mind. To help another person often requires little effort on your own part. And even when it does prove to be a difficult task, the effect it has on another person is far greater than the effort you put in. Jonah is involved in several school and community organizations, including Junior ROTC, the National Forensic League, Jazz Choir, the South Valley Community Agricultural Project, and Speech and Debate. A natural leader, he coaches and helps his speech and debate teammates, contributing a positive team attitude, talking peers through their problems, and even mopping the floor at the end of practices and competition. The most significant person in his life is his grandmother, who raised him, giving him the proper tools and mindset to succeed on his own. His grandmother is Bahati Ansari. She started the No Hate Zone in Eugene, Oregon. She no longer lives in the state of Oregon. November 2012, Springfield, Oregon. The parents, the brother of this young lady came to the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs seeking to find out what it has happened to his sister sometime around Thanksgiving 2012. We're still trying to determine what happened to this young lady. I've been trying to get the information from Springfield Police, and what I've heard from her relatives is that the Springfield Police has told them, unless someone comes forward and confess, there is nothing more they can do. You just heard the testimony from Dow. Very powerful. I have no more to add to that. There was another incident in Springfield, Oregon, and the Springfield Police Captain, Rich Harrison, stated, I can't imagine going through something like this, especially as a 15-year-old. 15-year-old going about his business in Springfield, Oregon. is followed by a pickup truck with a Confederate flag as its occupants yell racial slurs and threatened violence upon the 15-year-old. He had to run for his life. Luckily, he had a cell phone with him to call his mother, who took him to the Springfield Police Station. I think this incident ended up with a conviction. Hate crime index, as provided by the USA.com. This data shows consistently higher hate crime indices for the state of Oregon from 2006 to 2010 as compared to the rest of the nation. Blue represents Oregon. Springfield, Oregon. The latest data available on Springfield, Oregon shows over 200 reported incidents in 2010 as compared to the U.S. average of 23. Again, Springfield, Oregon is in blue. Redmond, Oregon. If you look at 2008, 1 year after the death of LaMarcus Petit, the hate crime index spiked to 119 in Redmond, Oregon. Redmond, Oregon is in blue. This is data presented by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Highlighted is Oregon, and you may not be able to read it correctly, but of the 216 participating agencies in Oregon, only 30 have submitted incident reports. That resulted in 134 reported incidences. If we should make some assumptions based on this data, if all 216 agencies reported based on an average of 4.5 incidences per agency, that would result in a total of 965 incidences for the state of Oregon, but that only includes participating agencies. So 965 incidences does not even come close if we had all agencies reporting. The reason I provide this data to you today is to recognize, to provide something that you can put your hand on. This is not a feeling. This is not a perception. This is real. It is present, and it's dangerous. It's deadly. And I come today to ask you to support this bill so that it provides our community with some semblance of protection. That is all I ask of you. I have a 26-year-old black male living in Oregon. I brought my son to the state of Oregon from Trinidad. Since I've come to the state of Oregon, I have had to tell my son things that he has never grown up with living in Trinidad. I live with the fear daily of getting a phone call, and I pray that I never get it, that someone motivated by hate will attack my son. I plead to you today as a mother, as an immigrant, as a citizen of the United States of America, to seriously think of this. If we want to put it in fiscal terms, Oregon needs to consider whether it wants to be a state that attracts the brightest and the best, or if it wants to be a state to be known where you stay away regardless. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Clifford Walker, Stephen Ying, and Diane Sykes. And again, I ask you to try to keep it about 3 minutes. We went a little over in the last one, but there was a lot of information that was important again. So go in any order, but please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Baker and distinguished legislators. My name is Clifford Walker, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm here principally to put a face on so many victims of racism. I'm an Oregon native, and I guess I've been hardened by the experiences I've had in Oregon. I hear these stories, I understand these stories. You can only imagine what a black man, I'm near 70, my next birthday, and it has been a fight every day of my life. I can tell you that. I joined the military when I was a young man, 17. And I had the good fortune or the bad fortune of being stationed at Adair Air Force Station, which is in the valley here. And I learned not only the face of racism in my city of Portland, but the way the soldiers were being treated when they were serving this country, just doing what young men do as soldiers, looking for entertainment. And it was horrific. I'm pleading to you, and I can't even expect you to understand my story, and that's I'm just here as a face. I ask you to support this bill, put some teeth into our laws, give people protection that they don't have, act as if you're serious about protecting people who are victims of racism, because I think we all know the story and the history of Oregon. It's no secret. And to make it short, I'm going to say I came to volunteering my services to the state as a commissioner on the Black Affairs. How I got involved in that was Commissioner Wilson talked about LaMarcus Petit. When I read the story about a man whose body was found on the railroad tracks in Redmond, I took it upon myself to contact the state to see if the state was looking into it. Was there anything they could share? I fear going outside of Multnomah County into other parts of Oregon, not knowing, like LaMarcus, what he might find in a state-licensed tavern or club. He lost his life. Like you say, I walked the crime scene. It was just a few blocks from where he had been racially assaulted. As a police investigator in the military, it didn't make sense that this man would leave a tavern and lay down on the railroad tracks and be run over by a freight train. It just didn't make sense. And so please, 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 that's all I can say, is take this appeal seriously, support House Bill 3480. And my last statement is, because I looked into my concerns about LaMarcus Petit, I was invited to volunteer on the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. I served for 4.5 years, 2 years as its chair and 1 year as its vice chair. And again, I have no explanation why the governor dismissed me from that commission. And I don't know if this is another sign at the highest levels in this state of this deep-seated racism that we have in this state. I felt that after 4.5 years of service, at least I was owed a modicum of respect for somebody telling me why I was being dismissed. Please consider our appeal and our concern.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Diane Schwartz-Sykes. I'm with Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3480. You'll hear a lot of testimony today about the reasons for why this bill is important. The commissions are here to provide substantive information about incidents. I'm here to talk about the nuts and bolts of what this law or this bill seeks to achieve. First, The bill seeks to rename the crime of intimidation to a bias crime. You've heard reasons today for why that would be appropriate in making it easier to identify this law and for victims to be able to know what our laws are in this state. But in addition, this bill, House Bill 3480, seeks to shore up the crime of intimidation 1, which currently is a Class C felony, but only applies to two or more people who act to either intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause physical injury or in a criminally negligent manner cause physical injury with a deadly weapon. If one person acting alone engages in those behaviors, it would not be encompassed under felony 1. And for that reason, we are in support of including actions by one individual as a Class C felony within Intimidation 1's existing framework. The bill also seeks to add the Attorney General as one party in addition to the District Attorney or a private actor who could bring a civil cause of action to seek redress for victims. As you've heard from some of the testimony today, and you will hear probably more of that testimony, people experience extreme emotional trauma from being victimized by hate crimes and also experience property loss. When there is no criminal case, there is no vindication or of those losses, and a civil remedy is a way to allow for a victim to still be made whole in this process and to seek justice for their injuries. And lastly, this bill seeks to bring the reporting requirements together in one location, the Oregon Department of Justice. If law enforcement agencies are directed to submit quarterly and annual reports, we will be in a better position down the line to establish policy going forward on how to improve the detection, prosecution, reporting of hate crimes. And for all those reasons, I'm asking for you to support House Bill 3480. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yang.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and representative in this committee. My name is Stephen Ying. I'm Oregon Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affair. And I'm here to thank you for letting the commission to turn in their testimony in support of HB 3480. Personally, I have someone close to me. My wife Helen, she was beaten up by the three people in the shower after the PE class just because she is Asian. And last year, our commission got a call from a Vietnamese family from a Grand Pass. They asking for our office to help their hate crime against them. This person have adopted by the mission from the church adopted him to come to United States for 33 years in Grand Pass. He grew up in Grand Pass and got married, have two children. And because the economic downturn, he lost his job. So instead of asking for the help from the government, they start a food cart and was doing really good business and to feed their family of four. And then later on, they received a lot of hate calling to their home phone, and also on the street they got called to tell them to go back to where they belong, Vietnam, they are not welcome in this Grand Pass. And one day when this gentleman went to work on the food cart, outside the home, got a call from his wife that there's a bottle bomb thrown in their house with two children, 3 and 5 years old, and her wife in the living room with the bomb thrown at them. So they called the police. The police said if there's no harm done, they're not coming to investigate the matter. So make the story short, it ended up we worked with the mayor in the Grand Pass, and the outcome was he received a lot of flowers and cards from the neighbor, from the resident of Grand Pass, make them feel like home again. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Representative Fredericks, did you want to testify, please? And I'll also call up Gina Skinner and Robin. It looks like Maren Collin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't see you.
That's all right. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I will be very brief. You've already heard the stories. This is not a difficult thing to understand with all of the stories that you've recently heard. I'm Lou Frederick. I represent House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I also happen to be the House Liaison for the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. I'm not sure why they chose me for that, but that's another story. This is a very simple bill in some ways. Makes sure that that victims of crimes involving bias are in fact dealt with. The original bill, we've worked on this, and the Department of Justice has worked on this for some time. We amended the original bill and ended up using a priority bill to incorporate all of the amendments and present you with a package which you have. I'm not going to go over the details of it. You just heard them, but there is a basic issue. And it's a basic issue of intimidation and bias, and the ability for, in fact, the state of Oregon to deal with those crimes that you've heard, the past crimes that you've heard, and to make sure that we are able to deal with anything that happens in the future. We need to be able to have the ability to actually make a difference in dealing with bias crimes, and that's what we're asking about here. It's not something that has come up just once or twice. This has taken quite a bit of work, and I hope that you will, in fact, pass it along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Do you want to go last? Please.
Good afternoon. My name is, for the record, my name is Robin Morris Collin. I am a professor of law at Willamette University, and I wish to thank you, Chair Barker, and Vice Chairs Garrett Krieger, Representatives Brent, Cameron, Hicks, Olson, and Tomei, and Williamson, for your time and your attention this afternoon. I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to testify before you. I brought my badge today, show and tell. I was a prosecutor for Maricopa County in the state of Arizona before I became a law professor. I believe passionately in accountability for conduct, and it is with passion that I wish to testify about this particular bill. Bias crimes are extraordinarily dangerous crimes. They are committed by extraordinarily dangerous individuals. You have heard the anecdotes. The anecdotes are moving and painful, and I salute the people behind me who have had the courage to recall them publicly. Those stories are my stories as well, but I don't propose to add any anecdotes. You have also heard the statistical data. It is profound. These are real issues. What I wish to add is to add an understanding of how broad the impact and how widespread the danger and risk that these individuals and these criminals pose to our communities. Bias crimes have an intentional impact on the safety of individuals, on the safety of families, and the safeties of communities. They are meant to tell people where they may and should not be. And they enforce this threat with implicit and explicit acts of horrific violence. The mistake we can make at times is to think that these are individual crimes and that they are intended to affect only individuals. They are not. They are dangerous to the communities involved because these kinds of individuals also are actively involved in other crimes. These are people who, in my opinion, should and are added to the registries of domestic terrorists. Their function is exactly the same. If you listen to the testimony about people who were in Boston yesterday, you will hear the same kinds of emotional testimony about how they were impacted and how they emotionally felt having been within the impact zone of some of these kinds of activities. I want you to understand that these people imperil not only people of color, not only lesbian, gay, transgendered, and bisexual people, they endanger all of us because their hatred, their violence, and their propensity and probability of acting upon it is a danger to every decent-minded person who walks the streets. They endanger our public places. They endanger our public communication. They intentionally endanger our ability to function as a democracy. And on that basis, I believe that they are entitled to enhanced attention, both from the Department of Justice, but also from the police and from prosecutors, as I was a proud member. One last point. These crimes have an intergenerational impact. This is not just about the people you see before us today. The conversation that our previous testimony has relayed to you is passed down from parent to child, not about ordinary prudence, not about reasonable caution, but about a state of affairs that says, if you are black, you are likely to be a target to someone. This is a conversation no parent, no grandparent wants to have. Attorney General Holder testified before our federal Congress that he has had such a conversation with his children. This is intergenerational. When I became a professor at the University of Oregon in 1991, my father said to me, don't drive through Grants Pass. They lived in Arizona. I said, Dad, how am I supposed to get home? He says, fly. This is into multiple generations, and it deserves to be apprehended, treated as a crime, and the danger that it poses intergenerationally and to multiple communities, and indeed to ourselves and our democracy, deserves the treatment that this bill would give it. I urge you to support House Bill 3480. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Ms. Skinner.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I've been a Deputy District Attorney for 16 years. I'm here to talk about this bill as well as House Bill 2314. The 2314 is another bill that is before this committee that basically addresses the same thing, but it is a District Attorney Association bill. And I want to talk about the distinctions between the two and the actual practical applicability of this law to what we do. The District Attorney Association is, of course, opposed to any criminal actions that are based on anybody's, their race, their color, their ethnicity, their gender, anything. We, of course, oppose all of that. But what I have to deal with every day is the practical applicability of this statute and how I can fit it to a crime that occurs. And the distinction that is made, first of all, is that all we're doing is changing the name of a crime that already exists. So the crime that already exists was intimidation in the first degree and intimidation in the second degree. So we're not creating anything new. This is already on the books. What we're trying to do is tweak it so it's easier to use. Currently, this crime is not prosecuted very often because it is not structured in a way that is very easy to use. Right now, Section 1 requires two or more persons to be involved in the actual crime itself, and it takes basically the crime of assault for the crime of menacing and then increases it to a C felony if it was done for any of the biased reasons, and that was the intention of the crime. What our bill does is for both the assault for and the menacing, reduces that so it's just the one person, because it was very challenging to get two persons there at the same time and be able to use it. It was unwieldy, so we got rid of that, so it's just one person. And in 3480, that only applies to the assault force section. They don't use the one person standard only with the menacing section. So the threatening of another victim is included in the felony section in 2314, but not in 3480. The other distinction between the bills is that in 2314, the District Attorney Association bill, one thing that was very important to us was including in the class of victims a community. There has been a number, and there has been comments from many of the speakers that we've heard here today, very compelling stories about communities that have been targeted. And that is something that we are very concerned about. And so if you have perhaps whether it's somebody that's destroying an important community or religious icon or puts graffiti up on in a prominent place where it can be viewed in the community, we want that to also be, that person to be held accountable for doing that action. 3480 does not address that issue at all. And so it is, again, challenging sometimes to focus that hatred to an individual versus a group of individuals or some size of a community. The other two aspects of 2314 that are not included in 3480 that we feel are very important, first of all, is that 2314 makes it so that both of the Intimidation 1 and Intimidation 2 cannot be civilly compromised, which means that there is a provision under the law that, certain crimes, if you pay somebody enough money, will go away. But there are certain crimes that is strictly prohibited. And currently, certain crimes like domestic violence and such, you cannot civilly compromise. Right now, you can civilly compromise intimidation, or if we rename this to a bias crime. But 2314 prohibits that from occurring. And the last thing on that issue is expungement, that 2314 makes it so that expungement does not exist, and then... Okay. Yeah. Representative Barton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was tracking everything, and I just my train just went off the tracks. I'm now confused. Which bill are we talking about, sir?
We're talking about two, but the 2314 was amended to allow civil compromise.
3480, what? 3480 was amended, you mean?
No.
Because 2314 already
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yesterday we just amended.
We had added that language.
2314, where we removed the civil compromise piece that was in there initially. Mm-hmm. And then also the expunction issue.
Okay, you removed
that. And
that
was passed out yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, that was
okay.
So now we're just talking 3480. Is that right?
Gotcha.
Okay.
I'm back on board. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank
Sorry
you.
About that.
No, I appreciate the information. That's very helpful. Thank
exactly.
you. But as far as some of the language that is in 3480, we do not object to adding the ethnicity and gender language to the statute. And additionally, in the civil relief sections, it adds the attorney general as a party that can seek that relief, where the currently it's just the district attorney. And there's other sections in there about criminal forfeiture that may or may not be particularly useful. But the general concept we approve of, but it's just that we believe that House Bill 2314 is a narrower, more focused bill, and it will be more user-friendly for the persons that are actually going to be utilizing this, which will be the deputy district attorneys in the state of Oregon, when they will be charging offenders, whether they're individually committing these crimes against another person or, we are hopeful, against a community that is a target. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate it. We do not have the paperwork to move this bill today. That's all trying to catch up. So we'll roll this on over till tomorrow. Close the public hearing. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2014 and call Sean Cruz, please. And then we'll be rolling that over for a work session, the bill we just heard, House Bill 3480. And if you could put in a call for
us.
No, we will have time. Please go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Aaron Cruz, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2014. I thank you all for your support on this bill in advance. I've already submitted some written testimony, which I won't go into too deeply. I just have some things I'd like to put in front of you. One of that is when a child disappears into the mountains or into the woods, there's a sense of urgency that everybody shares. But that sense of urgency does not appear anywhere if the child has disappeared with a parent. It does not appear anywhere. And that is from my own personal experience. I also want to say also that the first time I testified in the legislature on this issue was 10 years ago, and it was in this room before the Senate Judiciary Committee, 10 years ago. And before that, in the 01 session, was the first time I brought the issue to the legislature, and where I met Senator Gordley and briefed her on the story of the abduction of my children and what I had encountered in trying to recover my children. And she promised to work on the issue. And in 2002, she hired me to be her legislative staff. And going into the 03 session, I really believed that the key to this was to increase the penalties for custodial interference for causing a child to disappear. And our first drafts reflected that. But after meeting with the Judicial Department and the Department of Justice, I became aware that really the penalties are already plenty severe. The issue was enforcement. And then we started looking at the barriers to enforcement. I testified before Senate Judiciary and the Public Safety Sub of Ways and Means in the 03 session, and Senate President appointed the Parental and Family Abduction Task Force in 2004, and chaired by Senator Gordley and Senator Frank Morse. And I testified before the task force. The task force findings were very important. One, that they found that there's a general lack of awareness among law enforcement, among court officials, among the state bar, among professionals in the social services fields to the issue. There's a general lack of awareness of how serious the issue is. Also, the U.S. Department of Justice found that the number is above 100,000 children a year that are abducted by one parent or another, and yet there was no numbers for the state of Oregon because nobody tracks that. The state police missing a children's clearinghouse person reported that while the clearinghouse is authorized by statute to receive reports of missing children, local law enforcement isn't required to send them. And that is why there's a disparity there. And oftentimes, you report your child missing, that report doesn't go further than the city or county in which you filed the report. For an example, in 07, I took a state police ride-along Labor Day weekend, and while I was waiting for my ride, and I'm in the state police office at Mall 205, I'm reading the bulletin board, and there's a missing children poster in there with two children, 8 and 9 years old, that had been missing since February from Corbett, Oregon. And I was wondering, why is it that I haven't heard of this case before? And when I got home and went online to the state police website, those kids weren't there. That poster actually came from the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children. And so what I found in paying attention to the discrepancy over the years, there were times where there were as many as 17 kids listed on the National Center as missing from Oregon, most of them parentally abducted, and yet none of them listed on the state police site. So there are some statutory, as I've laid out in my written testimony, some statutory obstacles to this, and one of the most important is the definition of protracted. How long is protracted? Because the person has to intend to take the child or the children permanently or for a protracted period of time. How long is that? When does protracted begin? When does the actual abduction of this child begin? And what I want to suggest is that the person or persons, because most of these abductions involve more than one perpetrator, and while the law is generally applied as if it reads a parent who abducts the child in the custodial interference one law, it actually says a person. There's no exception in statute. The exceptions are in practice. And so the point is if the person or the persons makes the child disappear, then how long do you have to wait before the threshold of protected is reached? My children disappeared in February 12, 1996. And you know what? Their schools in Hillsboro never got a request for records from whatever school they were taken to. How can you place a child in school where they ought to be with no records? And my children never recovered from this academically, which according to the testimony of the members of Take Root, which were part of the task force, the abduction task force, is that lack of access to educational opportunity and also to medical care are just part of a part of their lives once they disappear. So I only have a couple of more comments. What I want to say also is that, and I want to express my gratitude because those of you that were here in 2005, Senate Bill 1041, Aaron's Law, named for my son, passed the House on a unanimous vote, a unanimous floor vote, and I will always be grateful for your support. But Since then, the law has kind of sunk from sight. The first instance of Aaron's Law being filed is in the Kyron Horman abduction, which is a special case all its own, but it is the first case. And it's the first time. You know, there, under Aaron's Law, it creates a civil cause of action. Oregon is the first state in the nation to have a civil cause of action for the crime of custodial interference in the first degree. And yet, you wouldn't even know about it. One of the things that is happening is that the child victims accrue the right to hold their abductors accountable in civil court through Senate Bill 1041. But with each passing week and month and year, there's additional cohorts of children who become adults and yet never knew that they had this right. So where Aaron's Law is designed to be a deterrent to people considering abducting their own children or helping somebody else abduct a child, it doesn't serve that purpose because nobody knows about it. And what I also wanted to say was that another thing that's not clear in statute and definitely not clear in practice is that people assume that when abduction takes place, that's the date of the crime. But it's a continuing crime, and it's a crime in progress. And one thing I hope that the committee will consider is not only when does the crime begin, the definition of protracted, but also when does it end? Because in my experience, it never ends. Does it end when the child becomes an adult and then the crime ends? Or in the case of multiple children in the same family have been abducted, does it end when the oldest child turns 18 or the youngest? You know, nobody considers these long-term impacts, but a child abduction has damages that last through the generations. And the last thing I'd like to say is that, you know, I grew up in a law enforcement household. My father was a patrol officer with the Solano County Sheriff's Office for 15 years, and my mom was a Solano County Superior Court Judge's secretary for the same period of time. And so I grew up worrying about whether my dad was going to come home okay. And but I also grew up with a very healthy attitude of the law and respect for the systems and machinery and the people that operate that. And so I'm asking you to consider this this bill very seriously and ask for your support. It's a very important bill. We need to know what happens when a child vanishes from Oregon and what happens when a child vanishes from somewhere else and brought to Oregon. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm sorry I'm a little late. I'm in another committee, and as you know, we're trying to rush through bills, so I'll try to be quick here. And I'm sorry if I repeat anything that that Shauna said. Each year, over 100,000 American children experience the trauma of abduction by a parent, a family member.
You need to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm Alyssa Kennegeyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. Some children are abducted back and forth repeatedly. Others disappear forever. Existing state and federal laws are inadequate to deal with the problem, as the staggering numbers attest. The harm is so severe that the best strategy is to prevent the abduction in the first place. The 2004 Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions laid the groundwork for Senate Bill 1041, Aaron's Law, in 2005. Aaron's Law, named after Sean's son, was designed to achieve two goals. One, provide relief to the victims with court-appointed mental health and legal professionals. And two, discourage child abduction through financial sanctions against the perpetrators and by requiring them to attend counseling sessions. Aaron's Law enables all abduction victims, child and adult, to sue the perpetrators for emotional and punitive damages. It creates a civil cause of action for the crime of child abduction, applying both to stranger and non-stranger abductions. Oregon is the only state in the nation with such a law.
So how has this made a difference? Among the findings of the 2004 Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions was the shocking realization that no state agency knew the number of non-stranger child abduction cases occurring in Oregon. This is still the case today. While some assumed in 2005 that the Oregon State Police would track this, there was no mechanism in Aaron's law to ensure this. House Bill 2014 is the first legislation on the issue since Aaron's law passed in 2005. It does three things. One, it calls on the Oregon State Police to report on the chain of events that take place when a child is reported to law enforcement officials as missing by the parent, grandparent, or legal custodian of the child. Under existing laws and practices, law enforcement and court officials ignore reports of abducted children from grandparents and non-custodial parents. Often it is a grandparent who is raising the children but has no standing in the court. House Bill 2014 brings the whole of the child's family into view. Two, House Bill 2014 calls on the Oregon State Police to report on the chain of events that take place when a child is reported to law enforcement officials as having been brought to Oregon in violation of a lawful custody order issued by a court of competent jurisdiction in another state. There has been no prior study on what happens when a child is abducted somewhere else and brought to Oregon. Three, House Bill 2014 calls on the Oregon State Police to report on any progress that has been made in conducting investigations of children abducted to or from Oregon since the issuance of the final report of the 2004 Senate Interim Task Force on Parental and Family Abductions. This study builds an important next step in identifying the gaps so that the legislature can consider further changes to the law. It is critical in preventing or at least mitigating the kind of pain that parents like Sean Cruz have suffered. So I'll just add that I have a friend, good friend, who is the Deputy Attorney General in California in charge of child abductions. I know that California has done a lot of work and is eager to work with other states on this issue. We, I think, are seriously behind on this issue. It's hard to even know what's happening and what to recommend until we study this. So I am hoping that your committee will pass this on to Ways and Means. If it turns out that Oregon State Police is not the appropriate body to do the study, we'd certainly be open to figuring out who would be. But I think this is a really critical issue. It's been almost a decade since we've done anything on it. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2014. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3228. Call Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Klein, State Representative from District 21 here in Central and East Salem. And I wanted to just talk about the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3228. I will let Deputy Herring talk about our conversation that led to the introduction of the bill, but the Dash 1 amendments narrow the bill, which is about the, in the current form, it's about engaging in medical use of marijuana around minors. The Dash 1s make it clear we're talking about smoking medical marijuana around minors, unless the minor is authorized by having a card themselves to actually be able to use medical marijuana. In general terms, I'm not a huge fan of smoking around children, period. I think the deputy can talk about an experience he's had as a school, an officer in a school with students who have been exposed to medical marijuana in an enclosed environment that he told me about that I think would be interesting for you to hear. And with that, I'll be quiet.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and rest of the committee. It's a privilege and honor to be in front of you talking about this today. My name is Senior Deputy James Herring with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. Been with the office close to 27 years. My passion for this bill is children, the protection of children. During my experience, what we're talking about is when I go to respond to a house, that we walk into a house that is you cannot see 5 feet in front of you. To make that point, from here to that projector is where a two-week-old child was in her little rocker coughing while approximately five to six others were sitting around in chairs where the person with the license for the medical, or the permit for the medical marijuana was smoking a bong, filling the house full of marijuana smoke. All individuals in that room, of course, showed signs of use of marijuana. The child, of course, that makes you sad and makes you angry, and the where the problem comes in is because the person who's using the marijuana is smoking it legally, there is no crime. So that poor child who is coughing and showing these signs of use of marijuana, the baby, there was nothing we could do. I am a school resource officer for Hawk Middle School and Adam Stevens Middle School. Now we're talking about middle schoolers, where we go to the houses and we're dealing with children who come to school with the signs and effects of marijuana on their person. They smell the marijuana, their eyes are big and black, they're usually late, or they don't come to school at all. Their grades are very poor. Conducive when we look at students who are actually out purposely using marijuana, you have the same effects. You go to the house, I'll open up the door, and I get blasted. Unfortunately, I was inhaling at the same time I opened up the door and was blasted with the child's parent, her mother, and I was underneath the effect of marijuana smoke because, again, the mother had a car to smoke medical marijuana, was smoking it legally, however, using a bong, filling the house full of marijuana smoke. This story goes on for several of these students. The bill, again, you know, there is nothing you can do because the marijuana is being smoked legally because the person who's smoking the bill, smoking the marijuana, is the parent who has the card. Inside the house, again, four to six others, some couple had warrants, are sitting around, again, all showing effects of smoking marijuana. However, again, the person smoking it was legal to do so. So there was no crime. So the I went to Mr. Clem with this request for this bill, and I appreciate your time listening to this bill, again, for the children, so that we can get the children away from marijuana. And it's not attacking the use of the medical marijuana person. They can smoke anywhere. Just please don't smoke it around children where they're being affected and their schooling's being affected, you know, dealing with smoking or being around the marijuana smoke.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. It's probably too late to amend this. I'm proposing, but it would be nice if someone would do something about the growing and manufacturing and
microphone.
The growing and manufacturing of medical marijuana in residences where 18 or under, where persons under the age of 18 also live, minor children also live, that's a huge problem too, in my opinion. I mean, people will just grow marijuana and medical marijuana and deal with all the transactional stuff that occurs there, and there'll be people, minors, living there observing the whole thing. So I won't propose an amendment, but that's my thoughts on the matter.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Okay, so we have roughly about 60 people that under OMMP that are registered under the age of 18 that have medical marijuana cards. What would you do with those? I mean, I realize you're targeting just age 18, but what about those that are under age 18 that have a card and also have families?
So thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. The Dash 1 amendments say that there's an exception to the prohibition on smoking around a minor unless the Oregon Health Authority has issued a there's a prevention of smoking around a minor unless the Oregon Health Authority has issued a registry identification card to the person who is under 18 of age. So if they are on the registry, as you mentioned, they're exempt from the prohibition because they have a card. And I met with my DA's office about, my first thought was, couldn't we do something under child endangerment if it's really that bad or some other charge? And Walt, our District Attorney Beglob, put me in touch with the people in his office who would do something like that. They said, no, there is not a useful statute for this situation for them to do anything about, because then they'd get into a whole scientific debate about whether or not, you know, it was endangering to be smoking them around, and they don't have the resources to win every single one of those cases. Whereas if we presume that it's not good to be smoking around children in an enclosed space, whether frankly it's a car or marijuana, you know, it's easier for them to do these kind of cases.
Okay, thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Next call, Leland Berger, Becky Strauss, and Anthony Taylor.
I know.
Again, I will ask you to please keep it short.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Many of our concerns with the bill seem to be addressed with the Dash 1. We were worried about smokeless use and also what happens when the cardholder is younger than 18 years of age. But I also want to just raise some other questions and pose the question whether this is really the direction we want to be going with this program. I think in regard to things that the Dash 1 does not fix, I'm curious about the situation where possibly someone younger than 18 is a caregiver in a house. I mean, the legislature has, we've made a commitment here in Oregon that the use for medical purposes of marijuana is lawful. And this is for the benefit of patients. And so, for example, the caregiver in the home, this would seem to impact the care of the person who really needs it for medical purposes. So I think that what we're doing here is contemplating going down the road of recriminalizing patients who are often very ill, sometimes terminally ill, and use this for the very little relief that they can find. And so I would urge to just, I think it's our recommendation that we do not go down that road with this program, but certainly want to pose the question. And I just also would insert here that there are very few other situations where we would regulate very sick patients in their homes about how they're using their medication. And so I would suggest that we don't do that in this area. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I've been practicing for 30 years. I represent patients and their providers statewide. I'm actually today en route to Gold Beach, where I have an appearance tomorrow morning. I'm appearing today on behalf of Compassion in Oregon in opposition to this proposal. I can tell you that I've been coming to the legislature since 1999, after the law passed in 98, and when Kevin Mannix chaired this committee, Donna Nelson, a representative from Yamhill County, asked me about secondhand smoke, and I told her then that there were no studies at all indicating any harmful effect from secondhand smoke, and I can tell you today that that's still the case. There's no science to support the deputy's claims, and the notion that smoking a bong fills a home challenges reality, I think. The concern I have specifically about the amendment is, and it's important to remember the construct of the Medical Marijuana Act, 475309 accepts patients and their providers from arrest, prosecution, and forfeiture so long as they stay within the limits and don't do the prohibited things. This would add a new prohibited thing in 375319, and as I read this amendment, if a parent were medicating using their medical cannabis at night in the kitchen while the kids were asleep upstairs, they would lose their protection of the Medical Marijuana Act. Now, those cases are already being prosecuted in places where, like Washington County, where there is extreme prejudice against, you know, medical marijuana, or here in Marion County. The other thing, I know that that the deputy sheriff and the representative are, care about children. There are other remedies for this. I mean, the advice I give to patients when they ask me, well, what about DHS coming and taking my kids? Not talking about being arrested for anything. The advice I always give is to treat it as if it were a dangerous medicine, which of course it is not. But that's important to do. You had asked Representative Hicks about gardens, and I always recommend that patients who have minor children in the house keep it in a place where it's locked. And in my experience, even in cases where they're criminally prosecuted, that's mostly what happens. And I think the same is true about the responsible therapeutic use of medical cannabis. I don't disagree that there are people like the deputy described that are not responsible about their therapeutic use, but overwhelmingly patients are, and there already is adequate protection for children through the Department of Human Services. Department of Human Services is, I mean, I you know, I don't do family law except when a medical marijuana parent is, there's a petition that the behavior, conditions, and circumstances warrant the state taking temporary custody of the children, and inevitably that relates to the kinds of situations the deputy described. So I can tell you those kinds of proceedings and that kind of mechanism to protect children already exists. Please don't criminalize people for their therapeutic use of medical cannabis by adopting this resolution or this bill. Thank you, Chair Barker.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Taylor, and I am the director of Compassionate Oregon, and I come before you today to ask you to reject this bill. Initially, it called for immediate proximity, and now the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, expands it to the whole dwelling unit. So that means if a parent's, like Mr. Berger said, a parent's medicating in the kitchen or in the garage, the minor is in within the confines of the building, you've got a violation. And these typically, again, as Mr. Berger said, most of the patients that are using cannabis do so with their children in mind. If there's children in the house, they don't smoke it in front of them. They keep it locked up. They are very careful about residues or any cross contaminations or anything of that nature. And I would just encourage the committee to reject this proposal, because it's really a, you know, a, what do they call it, a solution in search of a problem. It's just another way for, you know, prosecutors to stack more charges on and, you know, get to enhance the penalties of what they're going after. So, again, thank you for your time here, and I encourage you to oppose this amendment and this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3228 and carry over work session till tomorrow.
No.
And I have an announcement. The House Joint Resolution 1 is being set over until Thursday night, if anybody was here for that bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3183. Shannon White and Cindy Booth, please.
Christina McMahon as well. Christina McMahon as well.
That'd be fine. Yeah.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Associate Director at Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a nonprofit organization that's been around for about 14 years, and we advocate on policies that benefit both victims of crime and people of who have been convicted of crime. I am here today in support of House Bill 3183, which would make it permissible for youth who have been convicted as adults to be transported directly to an Oregon Youth Authority facility rather than having to do an intake process through the adult correctional facility at Coffee Creek, which is the current practice. We became aware of this situation a year or more ago from some of our members who contacted us and let us know that they had children who were spending this week in the adult prison at Coffee Creek. Those youth are usually kept in an isolation cell for their own protection, so we're doing sort of 23-in-1 isolation time, which is particularly hard on youth who have pre-existing mental health problems, which many youth, as you all know, in the juvenile justice system have. When we found out about the situation, we contacted the Department of Corrections, then Max Williams and Colette Peters with the Oregon Youth Authority, and said, hey, why do you do this? And they both actually said that they were unsure why that practice was in place and thought that it actually could make more sense for these youth to go directly to the Oregon Youth Authority facility where they're going to be doing their time until up until their 25th birthday on their adult sentences. So we thought we were going to move forward with that new policy change, and it turned out there were some legal and many bureaucratic and logistical challenges around transportation and with the Sheriff's Department to actually implementing that policy. So House Bill 3183 actually only changes the legal barrier to doing that, which is the statute that requires that youth be committed to the physical and legal custody of the Department of Corrections. The other logistical and bureaucratic things will be worked out at another time. So this is just to make that those negotiations able to go forward without a statutory barrier to that process. So this is important to us not just because youth are potentially subjected to an isolation cell, because I will acknowledge now that DOC has worked to the best of their ability to mitigate the impact of youth being in an adult facility and have shortened that intake process to just a few hours. We are still hopeful that we can work with counties or with the Department of Corrections to ultimately have those youth have to avoid contact with adult prisoners and the adult prison. So we urge your support of House Bill 3183. And I do just want to put on the record that we have been in contact with the Oregon Youth Authority, and they are neutral to the bill because it doesn't really change much for them. And the sheriffs as well are neutral on the bill.
Jeremy?
Yes.
Is the bill permissive or mandatory?
Permissive.
Okay, because it's not, the summary doesn't say that. That's what I thought, but the summary here tells us something different, so thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Christina McMahon. I am the Assistant Director, Juvenile Services Division Director for the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Multnomah County Department of Community Justice urges your support of House Bill 3183 with the -2 amendments. This bill would permit collaboration between key public safety stakeholders to encourage the successful transition of 16 and 17-year-old youth from local facilities who have been convicted of a Measure 11 or waived on other adult charges by allowing these youth to be taken directly to a youth correction facility for intake purposes rather than first going to Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, an institution for adult offenders. You might ask, why is this bill needed? In Multnomah County, and I've submitted written testimony and attached a copy of a resolution that Multnomah County passed in December of 2008. In Multnomah County, we have made the policy choice to lodge juveniles who have been charged with Measure 11 offenses in the Donald D. Long Juvenile Detention Center. Our county has made this choice so that youth who are awaiting resolution of their adult cases can receive age-appropriate services in an environment consisting of juvenile justice professionals who are trained to deal with adolescent development and behavioral issues. As a state, Oregon has also made the policy choice to incarcerate these same juveniles in youth correction facilities rather than adult prisons until they complete their sentences or reach the age of 25, and then they're transferred to an adult facility. Under current law, it is mandated that 15-year-olds who are convicted as adults are taken directly to a youth correction facility for intake purposes. Given the policy choices that have been made at the state and the local level in some counties, it is incongruent to transition youth from a local juvenile detention facility, then to an adult prison facility for intake, and then finally to a youth correction facility. While House Bill 3183-2 is permissive rather than mandatory in terms of intake procedures for older juveniles, this bill would provide an opportunity for collaboration between the Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, and local public safety agencies such as my own. While the length of time a youth is undergoing the intake process at Coffee Creek has been greatly reduced, the reality is that these youth spend the majority of their time in isolation, as Ms. White already shared, and they do have some level of exposure to adult offenders, and they are being supervised and monitored by adult correctional professionals. These conditions are known contradictions to what we know to be best practices with juveniles. House Bill 3183-2 provides an opportunity for agreements to be reached that could lead to protocols which reflect greater consistency with public policy choices our state and communities have already made. This could in turn enhance the successful transition of youth who are serving adult sentences in youth correction facilities. I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Booth. I'm with the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here today to provide information with regard to House Bill 3183 and the impact on the Department of Corrections. The department is philosophically in agreement with what this bill does. We have identified a need for a slight change with regard to the statute that's being revised and would appreciate the opportunity to work with Partnership for Safety and Justice and Oregon Youth Authority and stakeholder partners on revisions that are minor on the other side. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who could describe this or answer this question, but the intake process, things that inmates go through in their first day or their first visit, there is some assessments and things that take place at DOC. Is it the same for the OYA if they were to go direct to OYA?
Chair Barker and Representative Cameron, the Department of Corrections intake process is similar, not the same, as Oregon Youth Authority. We both do risk assessments. The process that we need to hone in order to accommodate this is to ensure that the paperwork, the judgment orders, and other information from the courts and the counties are received in a timely fashion so that our offender information sentence computation folks can begin the process of determining the sentence calculations, et cetera. The assessments we do are related to health, physical and mental health reviews. There is a risk needs assessment, but all of that is abbreviated currently, and the majority of that work is done at the Oregon Youth Authority once the youth arrives at that location. So we have access to that information because they input a lot of it into their information system that we can get to, but there is currently a need to do a better job of making sure that information the department requires is in hand as quickly as possible once the youth is delivered to Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel. Mr. Taylor.
Sure. If I may ask one question. Shannon, when we're talking about the amendment, the dash two amendments, the way I'm reading that as it relates to line 14, when person is under 20 years old at the time of sentencing, was under 18 at the time of the offense was committed, the sheriff may deliver the defendant directly to the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority.
That's correct.
Is it not? So, I mean, I assume there's no other place they can deliver them. So it would have to be the Youth Authority, would it not?
I do not have the bill in front of me right now. I know it is the intent of everyone on the bill, and it should be reflected in that it is permissible to have the youth committed to the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority or the Department of Corrections while they remain committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections. And I think the wording changes that are being proposed by the Department of Corrections may be clarifying to the language, although we will want to be clear that the intent is the same. I think some of the Department of Corrections lawyers will be working with Ledge Council to ensure that this is clear.
Okay, thank you. One of my concerns. So, this says if somebody is 20 years of age at the time of sentencing, 18 when they commit the crime. But so if they're not sentenced and charged until they're an adult, even though the crime committed earlier, would they not go to DOC?
This language, while slightly reversed from for some reason, but this language came out of other parts in the statute that are addressing this population. For some reason, in this drafting, it's slightly in reverse order, which I think is part of what the lawyers at the Department of Corrections are going to be addressing, but that language is consistent with other statutory language that addresses 16 and 17-year-olds who are convicted as adults. There are separate statutory language for 15-year-olds who do not ever come into contact with adult jails or prisons.
Okay. Any further questions? I'm totally confused on this one. Okay. I mean, I understand the idea is so we don't take juveniles and stick them to Coffee Creek if possible. That's what the goal is. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Committee, this language probably needs clarification, but this is a bicameral legislative process, and we do have a deadline coming up Thursday. So it could be clarified in the other chamber because it would be almost impossible to get an amendment and get the fiscal impact statement.
Okay, Representative Hicks.
Refer to rules, perhaps? I mean, we've been working this. Would you be all right with that?
I'm sorry?
I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yes, let's do it in rules. Sure. We'll work it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's keep working out on this side. We'll send it to rules.
We'll try to get it fixed before we move it over to the other side of the building. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2920 and open a work session on House Bill 2920.
Thanks for the inspired suggestion.
I know you're looking for more work.
Chair Barker, that's the first time I've ever seen Representative Garrett excited about a bill.
Mr. Chair, it's...
Oh, I'm sorry.
31.
I'm sorry, I said the wrong bill number.
Yeah.
We're still on...
The Hicks work group.
Yeah. This is on 3183. This is the bill we're moving to work session. So
that's sorry, which one?
3183. So 3183...
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3183 to the Committee on Rules.
Okay, I'm going to roll this over till tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close that public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2920. Representative Tomei,
and I think there's somebody coming.
Yeah, there is. And Mr. Gilmore, once again, I'll ask you to please be brief in that we need to get the work session done today.
Yes.
Thank you. But obviously, you need to say what you need to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative for House District 41. Thank you for hearing this bill today. This bill came out of a conversation with Lois Day, the Child Welfare Director, and other personnel from the Department of Human Services. This bill would permit DHS to remove some inapplicable and potentially confusing language from a written notice the Department is required to provide when conducting criminal background checks when investigating child abuse or neglect. When they run a criminal background check, the law requires DHS to provide written notification to the person being checked. This informs the person of their right to challenge the background check and provides information on how to do so. Part of this notification is language relating to the Federal Civil Rights Act and employment discrimination. House Bill 2920 changes the required language in the notification when DHS runs background checks related to abuse or neglect investigations. DHS would still have to inform individuals of their right to challenge the content of the record. This bill simply removes the statutory requirement to provide extra information that is inapplicable and confusing. I'll pass it off to Harry Gilmore from the Department of Human Services.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Harry Gilmore, and I manage the Interstate Compact and Contracts Unit for the Department of Human Services. I'd like to thank Representative Tomei for her sponsorship of this bill. The bill is fairly limited in scope. As Representative Tomei pointed out, it changes just a small section of the notice that we provide to individuals that we run background checks on as part of our investigation of a report of abuse or neglect of a child. It doesn't alter the notice that we would provide in any other circumstance when running a background check. So it's very limited to just this one set of circumstances. You know, the department runs background checks for things like employment screening and licensing and other purposes, and in those instances, we're actually getting the written consent of the individual before running the check. But in this circumstance, in a response to abuse or neglect, it's critical that we obtain criminal information quickly as part of our assessment to ensure child safety and to ensure that we're looking at the right things when conducting an assessment of a report. This will eliminate confusion on the part of the public, and potentially, you know, if people see that we're that the notice that they get talks about rights related to employment, they may think that their employment may be affected by the background check that we're running, and that's the last thing that we want folks to think. Our check is only to do with our assessment of child safety. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. DHS supports the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2920 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2920 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Tomei, would you carry for us, please? Thank you. We'll move to a work session. I'll open a work session. House Bill 2595. We have the dash 4, 6, and 7 amendments.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, House Bill 2595, let me get to find my staff measure summary. Essentially, this bill would create the crime of interference with state forest land management. There are the three amendments that you talked about. The dash 4 is a constitutional fix amendment that makes it specifically apply to communication that behaves, that the behavior hinders or impairs or instructs the performance of the forest practice only in the manner or place. So in other words, it's not the content of the speech, it's the time and place of where the speech is happening and that it's obstructing the forest land management. The dash 6 amendment is also a constitutional amendment that makes this interfering with forest management apply to or exempts people who are present on state forest land or access roads as a business invitee or licensee and who is engaging in exercising a right or duty pursuant to a contract that they entered into. The dash 7 amendment on this bill modifies the criminal penalties, making the first conviction a Class A misdemeanor. And the second conviction of the crime is a Class C felony, which would carry a 13-month prison sentence. Now, that is not to say that a district attorney could not charge the first time as a violation down from the misdemeanor, which would then make essentially your second conviction be the misdemeanor and your third conviction be the felony if the DA elected to so pursue it that way. So those are the three amendments on the bill that are before us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tomei.
Did I understand you to say that it was a constitutional amendment?
I did say that, Representative Tomei. It's not amending the state constitution. It's an amendment to this bill to make it work with the state and federal constitutions.
Sure, it is constitutional.
To make it constitutional.
It's an amendment that adjusted the bill to make the bill constitutional.
Oh, I see. Yes.
It was my mistake.
You. Okay.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah. Mike, on the dash 6, the one that exempts contracts, has any constitutional review been done of that provision?
Yeah, Rep. Garrett, specifically, I was contacted by ACLU on that. They shared a court case with me. I shared that with LC. It was a case dealing with a different statute, an agricultural statute, but kind of similar aims. And so LC is aware of this case. They looked at it, and they believe that the way that this is drafted would not implicate the equal protection problems that that case had. Because that case, that statute was written in a way that labor unions specifically were exempted. And the way that this dash 6 is written, it talks about a person who is an invitee or licensee on the property, or it is talking about someone who enters into a contract, which could be anybody. And essentially, that agricultural statute fell because of the equal protection that
union members were being treated differently as a class than other people. But they believe, LC, as this is drafted, that it wouldn't implicate the same equal protection problems.
Thanks.
Further questions? Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2595.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2595. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 2595.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 2995. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2595.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 7 amendments into House Bill 2575. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2595 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2595 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Krieger will carry. Open a work session on House Bill 2596.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2596 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee, House Judiciary Committee, creates a cause of action for private entity contract with State Forestry Department to perform forest practices. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will see the Dash 3 amendments in front of you. And going to the original bill on line 13, it takes out the issued after damages plus $10,000. So all you would do is get damages. And then down on line 14, after access road, it would say on state forest land. There should be no constitutional issue here as far as those issues go.
Okay, thank you.
Dash 3s.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 3 amendments in House Bill 2596.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 3s in House Bill 2596. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2596 as amended to the floor for due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2596 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I mentioned earlier the House Joint Resolution 1 will be rolled over to Thursday night. Carried over. And I want to suspend the rules.
To the end.
And go back to House Bill 2920. Representative Tomei, we didn't have the fiscal on your bill yet.
Oh, okay.
So I'll rescind the rescind moving it down to the floor, and we will roll that over so we can get the paperwork.
Thank you.
Yes, and Representative Krieger will be carrier of the 2596. On House Bill 2559, groups have come together and asked that that be set over and handled in the interim to this is the law modifying law regulating establishment and modification of spousal support and domestic relations proceedings. There we tried to get that fixed. We were unable to do that, and we won't have time, so I asked a group to take care of that in the interim. Next, opening work session on House Bill 2607.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2607, you'll see the Dash 5 amendments in front of you. It allows credit against a prison sentence for credit for time served. We have the Dash 5 amendments, which basically rewrites that statute for the purposes of clarification and sets forth when credit for time served will be given. As chair, members of the committee, there still probably needs to be further work done on this amendment, but we probably don't have time here, and we do not have fiscal revenue and tax statements as it relates to Dash 5 amendments. Chair, members of the committee, you decided you could adopt the Dash 5 amendments, and then when we get the fiscal tomorrow, we could then move the bill.
Okay.
If you choose.
Okay.
Chair.
I'll entertain a motion. Yes.
If there's a better amendment to Dash 5, I'd like us to, this is going to save money. I strongly believe it in a way that is kind of difficult to explain. Can we send it to the Joint Committee on Public Safety that's currently comprehending these issues in a global fashion? Is that possible? And then work on an amendment that's going to make sense in a package kind of format?
We'll need to get permission to do that. We might. I'm not sure if that's the right committee to move that to either. They're kind of tied up on other things.
True enough. True enough. I think.
If we only got Olson and Garrett to do any work during the interim, we probably.
If it goes, I might have to keep my door locked. Yeah. The counsel for the committee may be after me.
Okay. We'll roll this over till tomorrow. Time being. And then open a close work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3363.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've already adopted the Dash 4 amendments to this bill, and this bill requires the Department of Human Services to disclose case plans and written information to court-appointed special advocates in juvenile court proceedings.
Okay, is there any discussion on this bill?
We have all the minimal.
Ready to go. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3363 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3363 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any objections? Any discussion?
Nope.
Okay. Seeing no objections, so ordered. Who would like to carry that bill? Okay. Representative Olson has hand up. We've got four spills. So Representative Olson will be the carrier. Looks like we beat the 3 o'clock deadline.
Well done. Good job.
Well, for their business committee adjourned.
Thank you.
You finally got your bills.
What do you want to know?